Good morning and welcome to Radio Zine. I'm Marianne Barasonic and my guest is Annette White Parks. She grew up in Monument, Oregon, where her Scots, Irish, and Welsh ancestors settled in the 1860s. She's collected the stories written by her father, Emmett Cochran White, in the book Cowboy of the Rim Rocks. It details cowboy life in Grant County, Oregon, from the 1860s to the 1940s. Annette, welcome to KABU.
Well, I love being here. Thanks, Marianne.
Now, your father died more than 35 years ago, and the book has just been published like this year. So there's kind of a long lag there. What happened?
Well, when my father died in 1972, he had shown me this manuscript while he was alive and wondered what to do with it that he had written on Grant County. He had been gone for 25 years, and he had written it after he left, and he wondered if I could know what to do with it, and I didn't. But after he died, I thought, well, something should be done with this, and I read it, and it was all about from the time his grandparents, my great-grandparents, came in there in the 1860s up until the time that he left, and my family left in 1947. And it was so rich and so full of the lore of the country and the people and the livestock and all the whole thing. I thought, I've got to do something with this, and I recall the Blue Mountain Eagle as Grant County's major newspaper. I remember always having that when I was a child. So I took the manuscript, and I went to see the editor of the Blue Mountain Eagle, at that time John Moreau, and this was in 1975. And I asked him if he would print the column, a column of the stories, and he did. I broke it down into, I broke the manuscript, which was one continuous manuscript, down into 65 stories that he printed in the Blue Mountain Eagle over a year and a half or so.
So what was the reaction from, did you get any sort of feedback from the people who, in the readers?
Well, I got wonderful feedback because in 1972, my dad's, you know, peers were still alive. And so I got so many letters of people that say, oh my gosh, you know, I remember this. And yeah, I was with your dad on this cattle drive and various things. It was very gratifying. But then, you know, when things come out in the newspaper, they're gone the next day. Mm. And so I thought, so they later added another 10 years. I was, at this time, I was raising kids and a returning student to college and various things. So in 1985, I decided, well, you should try to do something more with these. So I contacted the Oregon Historical Society. And they said they would print them in abridged form, not the total thing. And they did. In 1985, they printed in four different issues the stories, the segments, abridged. And then somehow I went back to grad school and I finished my degree and I went to work in Wisconsin. And of course, things lied fallow until I retired 5 years ago. And I thought, well, it's time to think about getting these into a book, so they can be seen. Somehow they kept nagging at me. It was like my dad's voice saying, do something permanent with these. And so that's how they happened to come out this year.
Well, it's an interesting book because it's this first-person account, and it's an honest account of what life was like there. I think we kind of get a glossed-over view. And we're going to do something a little bit different today because if you have people, your family came from that area, or if you want to talk to Annette about her growing up in Monument, you can give us a call, 503-231-8187. Again, my guest is Annette White Parks, and we're talking about her book, Cowboy of the Rim Rocks. When your dad wrote that he was growing up in the John Day area, he wrote, there was no sagebrush along the river foothills as there is now. Range stock never had to be fed in the winter, for there was an abundance of free grass and water. The country was full of wild game, be it fish, fowl, or animal. It sounds like in a very short period of time, the countryside was changed dramatically, because even when you were growing up, the sagebrush was there.
Yes, definitely. I remember the sagebrush very well because I used to walk under it to pick wildflowers. When you know you're that short, you can do that. and needlegrass, which was very hard on the throats of the cattle. I think the sagebrush and needlegrass came in when after the country was overgrazed with sheep and cattle both, and horses, I guess, too. And it just, it must have happened fast because I don't remember all that grassy plain that he talks about at all.
The other thing that your father is really honest about is day-to-day life there doesn't seem like it was this paragon of family values. I mean, it starts with he had a grandfather who committed suicide after he thought he had killed a man in a fight. His grandmother on his father's side just walked away from her children. And your grandfather, your father's father, basically had to raise himself. So it's kind of a portrait of a very tough time to be growing up.
I think, Dad always said it was hard country on women and horses. And I think for women, it was especially hard. Often I know in the case of my family, the men, my great-grandpa wanted to come there. I don't think my great-grandma was so keen on leaving her home in Missouri and coming out. But I look at the men, especially in my family. And, today we would use the term abusive. Then it might have been accepted. But the great-grandpa you mentioned, William Wallace Cochran, he was quite brutal from what I can tell. And he was a womanizer, as people used to say. And after his death, my great-grandma, he had the original homestead there, and she was institutionalized in the Salem, what they called then the insane asylum. And I always wondered why, and I was never quite able to find out. I know a lot of women were institutionalized to get their land, to get their homesteads, and I always wonder if that was connected.
So what would happen is they would declare the women insane and then they would lose their property?
Yes. And I did check the records in Canyon City where Grant County records are kept at the county seat. And they had a paper there. It was signed by three men, a psychiatrist, a judge, and an attorney, or a neighbor that had complained about her. And I've not got back to checking the records of what happened to the land after that. But when women were left widows, they were very vulnerable. She was also a midwife, which was under suspicion. That's one way she supported herself and her children after husband was gone.
Why would a midwife be under suspicion?
Well, they were always associated with being kind of witchy and doing natural healing. And of course, all of our mothers did natural healing in that country because there wasn't a doctor for 70 miles. But this was always something that was looked on, even while it was a very useful service in the community and people used it. They were always it was something that a woman was looked down on a little, considered a little suspicious that she had these abilities.
Oh,
where
that's
were they coming from? Yeah, it's kind of alarming, but true.
And if you want to join in the conversation, the number again is 503-231-8187. Well, that's kind of interesting because your father doesn't mention any of that in the book. He doesn't mention his grandmother being committed. He doesn't mention that she's a midwife. He must have known this.
Hey, I didn't even know this until I went back after his death. When I took the stories back, I got reacquainted with Grant County for the first time in 25 years. And an old timer, I was full of questions, of course, and I wanted to know. And he is the one that told me that he thought there were rumors, and then I took it from there. They didn't talk about those things in those days. They were disgraceful. They were shameful. They were embarrassing. You didn't mention it. So she was just a kind of blotted out, which, of course, was another thing hard on women. Not only did, the fact that their names got lost in history because there was something there that was shameful. People didn't want to talk about.
Now, your father writes mainly about the men, and his uncle Emmett sounds like quite a character. In the third grade, he hit his teacher with a stick of stove wood, and, he sounds like the kind of person that would probably be considered borderline personality disorder or something and kind of locked up.
Yeah, at least he'd be certainly considered for treatment, and I'm sure given some kind of a label of bipolar or whatever. But I don't know. I know that this country didn't have a whole lot of laws in those days. From what Dad always said, if you wanted to commit a murder, go to Grant County. And I don't know how. You know, I really don't know what the consequences were of him hitting that teacher with a stick of stove wood, but. Certainly wouldn't be popular today.
Yeah, it seems like this was a place that there was a lot of anarchy and a lot of freedom.
Often I think together, yeah. I think Dad made the statement in there somewhere that, yeah, about the freedom and the lawlessness both. Yeah, that was there. That I think maybe the people that settled there, the men that settled there especially, we're looking for that kind of open freedom from restrictions. It's such a remote country.
Right, right. This may explain some of the character of, like, the way that people in rural Oregon are so suspicious of any sort of government now is because they're coming from this tradition where basically there was no law enforcement.
No, it was 70 miles away, just like the doctors. John Day was the closest. Pendleton, you know, was 99 miles away. And I think, yeah, they were used to really taking care of those things themselves. And just didn't small town villages do or not taking care of them, just kind of. I would guess that from everything I heard growing up, laws were fairly absent. And it could be a carryover today. I don't know. I know when I went back with this book last fall, I was surprised how many people still have that ancestral relation to the past, how many cousins and various people are still around from that
so,
era.
How has the area there changed?
You know, one of the things that shocked me most about going back to Monument after 25 years, it didn't look like it had changed on the surface. Because we hardly ever go. I went back to John Day and couldn't find my grandma's house. It had been leveled. And savings and loan had been put in its place. And even the hill it stood on had been taken down and put by the mining piles on the river. But in John Day, everything looked the same. My dad's ranch, even the barn had its no smoking sign on it. You know, the outbuildings, everything. But if you look closely, there were stakes. You know, by little narrow, snaky roads, but there were stakes off the roads where there were freeway rights to put in a widened highway if they wanted. The man who had bought my dad's ranch had it bought out from him by a developer. My dad sold it for $4,000 in 1947, and this man sold it for $200,000, I think, to a California developer who was holding it and leasing it back to him. And I think so. There's a lot of underneath changes that you don't see on the surface in terms of modern development and what's going on.
Yeah.
And prices have gone up considerably. We couldn't believe that a little house by the river was $250,000 in Monument, Oregon.
Right. But that's kind of true all over the place.
But you don't expect it in a small town like you do in the city so much. The fact that people are using that Grant County is a getaway spot. People who are coming from the cities who want this remoteness and maybe freedom at some underlying level. Maybe we do like this freedom from the restrictions that are more visible in the city.
Right. So even though, the doctor was 70 miles away, another thing that was probably very far away would be any sort of banking or financial institution. And
yes.
Your grandmother had a small inheritance that she then lent out, and she made quite a bit of money from the interest.
Yes, I don't know the details of how much interest she charged. I know that she had a first husband she was married to 10 years, and the legend has it he was killed chasing a grizzly bear down Main Street. I don't know how true that is. But anyway, he left her a small inheritance. He left her the general store and monument. And he left her $2,000 life insurance policy, and it was a life insurance policy that she lent out for cars just coming into Grant County for people buying autos. I don't know what interest she charged, but I know she accumulated quite a wealth from it.
Right. And it wasn't like she had started a formal bank or anything. It was just that there was no other kind of way of access to capital. And she was there. So she kind of just did this business out of her house.
Yeah. I don't know when the Grant County Bank came in. It was in John Day. And so there would have been a bank available in my childhood. The bank was there and she was there too. So how that worked together, I don't know. Maybe she gave loans to people that the bank turned down. I don't know.
Yeah. But it's kind of interesting because it's like given the size and the kind of unmanageability of like the credit card industry and everything, this is almost something to think about as a model for how we could maybe take back control over our finances is the same kind of idea.
Ah, that's interesting to think about. So to start borrowing from each other instead of the banks.
Right.
That's a great idea.
Now, another thing that was surprising for me in the book is there was a cultural diversity out there. You had the Hispanic vaqueros, and then you had Chinese people in the area too. And it seems like everybody kept to themselves. There was insular groups, but they pretty much got along.
Well, that's very interesting to me. The fact that this book has as much cultural diversity as it is in it, and that Dad identifies people by their ethnic origins. For instance, Jake. Remember Jake, the Portuguese ranch hand who saw his friend going down the river on a hay wagon that had broken loose from the horse. And, and he was watching him and saying, no more binge, you know. And he identifies him as the Portuguese farmhand. And the community was largely, like I said, Scots, Irish, and English, and so on, the mainstream, the dominant community. And that's identified. And, of course, the Chinese you mentioned in John Day, the Chinatown, that Dad used to go down and gamble when he was a kid after he moved to John Day, that the teenagers would go down, the Chinese doctor. I was especially fascinated by the Mexican vaqueros and the way Dad said that they had influenced so much of the cowboy practices. What he thought, and I don't know the truth in this, that the word buckaroo even came from vaquero. But he credits the Mexicans with giving the cowboys of that area most of their talents when it came to making saddles, when it came to braiding rawhide and making the riatas that they used for lassos. And I think the ethnic diversity is something that certainly he would have never thought of calling it that, but it's predominant all the way through, isn't it? And how much more was there?
Right. It's hard to say. And if you have memories of Eastern Oregon or would like to join in the conversation, give us a call, 503-231-8187. Doc Hayes, your father writes about him. He's the Chinese herbalist who was very well regarded in the area. That kind of surprised me, too.
Yeah, there was a whole Chinese community in John Day at that time, referred to as Chinatown John Day in the book. And there were a number of Chinese men left over from the mining, the gold rush in Canyon City, that had stayed. And there was a Chinese doctor and another Chinese man who lived with him, and they were herbalists. And throughout their lifetime, they were much sought out by the white community for their medicine, very highly respected. And the place they once lived has been made into a museum today in John Day.
Right. And now you said that your dad, when he was a kid, would go over to Chinatown to gamble.
Yes.
That was the other thing that struck me. Your dad started roping cattle when he was like 9 years old.
Yeah, that was another aspect that has struck people about the book, the role of children. Of course, the role of children in the West in general is, you know, they didn't have the kind of childhood that our kids do today, right? In terms of all the toys and things, they seem to be kind of out there involved in the work of the ranch. But the freedom also, you mentioned the gambling. I mean, teenagers going down to Chinatown and gambling and drinking and smoking and all these, they were there didn't seem to be the laws against that then. But also, it struck me the fact that he would be out there roping and riding. He said he learned to ride before he learned to walk, which a lot of things said, and he grew up on a horse. But the fact that he would ride after his parents moved to John Day when he was 12, and it's 70 miles back to Monument, and he loved Monument. So in summers, he would ride back, you know, by himself. This, I think today we would think of 12, 13, a little too old, young to take that kind of a trip by yourself.
70 miles on horseback.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that would be, and then for a while, he trapped muskrat and skunk for a living.
He did this as a kid for money, yes, in his teens. The trapping, I think, was one way that they...
Muskrat, I could see, it was, but skunk?
Well, as you remember from my recall from the book, he had a bad experience with the skunk. He couldn't quite get rid of the odor. But skunk made nice fur. I think it was just the olfactory organs were really a little hard to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've spent a lot of time researching this and putting the book together. Oh, and I want to mention, if people are interested in getting the book, the Oregon Historical Society store has the book, also Broadway Books. And Annette, you have a web page, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just put an email address there because the web page is still a little uncertain for orders, but the email address would work.
Okay, so if you want to get a hold of Annette to find out about getting a copy of the book, her email address is white-pa.anne@uwlax.edu. So you spent a lot of time on this. Why do you think it's so important for us to know our own family histories?
Well, I guess if we lived in the small villages, you know, of 100 years ago, 200 years ago, maybe even going further back, we wouldn't so much be intent on that. I think maybe we have been breaking off for so long from the places we were born, the places our grandparents were born, the places our ancestors were born, somehow we seem to feel an urge to go back. Maybe it's about connection. Maybe it's about feeling that I belong somewhere just besides just to myself. But there seems to be a great, to know where we come from, to know who we are, to kind of plug in our identity with something besides our lone selves. I think that especially in the United States, there's such a drive for roots now. And the fact that we all migrated from someplace and found ourselves in this vast continent together, and we seem to need to know where we are individually, I think on almost an instinctive level, outside of the practical things that are coming out genetically now for our, you know, for our disease.
Right.
And with DNA for our disease inheritance and for our family patterns that we're seeing that go across time. But also, there must be something collective there that we'd like to know about family history too, though, because the responses I've got to this book from people have been over and over, even people that have no idea of cowboy world in Sacramento, say, California, or in New Jersey, people in totally different parts of the country say, it talks about the days that used to be. It talks about a way of life that we used to have. And I guess maybe it's a way of life we all share somewhere in our genes or something. I don't know. But there seems to be a collective interest even in other people's history, not just our own.
Right, right. One of the things that I thought was interesting is, for example, your father's Uncle Emmett got divorced. Apparently he had a son who drowned. And after that, he kind of, everything fell apart for him. But we don't think of people in the early 1900s as getting divorced. And this was something that was a surprise for you too, wasn't it?
Well, it was a surprise for me because when I divorced my first husband, my mother said, there's never been a divorce in the family. And she tried to talk me out of it. Then I found out she had a grandmother who had been married 7 times.
seven times. How did she get married seven times?
I don't know. And I don't know if the husband's died or if she was divorced. I can't say for sure, you know, what happened there. But I know I have an aunt, a great aunt in that region who had three husbands. I think two of them died. I had, you know, it didn't seem like divorce was that. You mentioned my grandma on the white side of the family who left the family. Maybe I don't really know her. I don't really know her reasons. I know nothing about the white side of the family, practically nothing. So I don't know what was behind that. But it seemed like divorce was something that certainly happened.
Right, right. Okay, and my guest today is Annette White Parks, and we're talking about her book, Cowboy of the Rim Rocks. And it's a memoir that she edited. Basically, it was written by her father. You know, your father worked with animals his whole life. And one of the things that comes through in the book is his compassion for the animals who, the people were, people generally didn't treat the animals well, but he seemed to have a real connection with them.
Yeah, I think he loved the animals. And I don't know if it's true that I think a lot of the men who worked with livestock might have treated, I'm sure there were all kinds. Men that brutalized their wives probably brutalized their, you know, milk cows too. I don't know. But I know it was brutal on things, the bear baiting. We talked about that when they would bring in a bear.
Why don't you describe that a little bit?
I'm not sure that I can, but they would capture a wild bear, bringing him into town, put him in a pit and bait him to fight, say, with the dog. The bear always ended up getting killed, and the bear was just a captive. And that was kind of thing was cruelty. And I think it was hard on, of course, the livestock industry in general is very hard on all kinds of animals. But he had a love for the animals, too. There's a piece here I just love to read that illustrates that. It's quite short. May I?
Yes, absolutely. And is this the mules?
The mules that he talked about, this one man beating. I think it was very looked down on to be cruel to animals, though. They went their course. They might end up, you know, going to the slaughterhouse. But in the meantime, I think the ranchers I knew, they wanted them to have a good life. They were kind to their animals. Their animals were part of the family until that day came.
Right.
And so, but this really illustrated that to me after we were talking. Dad was talking about being on the trail. You know, there were no railroads coming in and no trucking. In my dad's younger years, they had to drive all the cattle. They rounded them up and took them from Monument to Hepner, which was, I'm not sure how many miles away. But he talked about this cattle drive. And here is how he talked about the animals. He says, these fat steers are good companions on the trail. Big steers are wonderful to be with when fat and handled correctly. They are good-natured, have a sense of humor, and are friendly fellows in general. Sometime right around break of day, 3:30 or 4 a.m. in the summertime, every big steer will wake up, get slowly to his feet, size up the situation, sigh a long sigh, then turn around and lay down in his bed again. In the morning, if the feed is good, they will graze off the bed ground and the buckaroos will gently point them toward the shipping point. He could be talking about people there.
Right.
The way he describes these cattle, you know, it's such a loving sort of companionable family sort of tone I get from that passage.
Right. And the one part that I loved, he talked about how the mules liked this mare named Belle. He loved them. And if you wanted to find the mules, all you had to do was look for Belle, because no matter where she was, the mules would be following her around.
Yeah, the animals do achieve personalities, don't they?
Yes.
I think the people were that close to their animals. That's another disconnection that we don't feel in the city in 2010, right? But they had this closeness that the animals were part of their family.
Right, right. And factory farming doesn't allow that
no.
connection to happen.
No, yeah,
part of the time that he writes about is during Prohibition, but apparently that doesn't mean much there. And there was a lot of illegal stills.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, home-brewed Homebrewed booze was, yeah, just part of the community, I think. And not necessarily in my time, because Prohibition was over when I was growing up. But, yeah, in earlier days, it was quite an accepted part of things.
So, for a while, your dad was doing trapping, and then he goes on to do these cattle drives. But it seems like he had a ranch there and he was doing okay. And then he's exiled from, he had to leave.
He didn't have to leave. He was self-exiled in a way. After his mother died, he had always had a bad sinus condition. And he had somehow got the idea that if he was in a dry climate like Arizona, he had migraines,
right,
and suffered from migraines, and he thought that might cure his doctors had told him this and so on. So after my grandma died, he went to he moved the family to Arizona,
right,
and that turned out to be a grave mistake and a sad turn in our lives, really. Because, well, my granddad was a tin horn gambler, they called him in those days. He not only gambled everything, he tended to lose. And my grandma, when she died, trying to protect the small fortune she'd accumulated, left my granddad an annuity to live on, but left my dad the full executive estate. And my granddad sued my dad, and my dad was so embarrassed it went through Grant County courts for 5 years. And they lost everything they have. A hold was put on his money in Grant County banks, and he had no money to even buy cattle anymore. And so he was ashamed to go back after that downfall, and so he didn't return.
Yeah, and that seemed like a really interesting marriage because your grandmother she was the one who had the small inheritance and had lent it out. She was a shrewd businesswoman, and she married this guy who was a gambler and couldn't hold on to money, and yet they stayed together until she died.
I know. It's kind of incredible, isn't it? But sometimes intelligent women can go for, rowdy men. And we have kind of history of that in my family. And I don't know why she stayed with him, because I think that marriage was abusive from what I've heard. You know, even though my dad would never talk about that, he grew up as an only child, kind of caught between them. And usually sided with his mother because of my grandpa's drinking and gambling. And I don't know that he hit her, but, you know, it was not a good marriage. But she stayed with him for some reason. I don't know why. But
and now she wasn't the only businesswoman in the area, too. Your dad talks about a woman who was running a dairy. And I think they called her like Mother Mary or something. It was Mother something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I'm not thinking of specifically the one you're thinking of right now. I know Aunt Tess, who was another branch of the Cochran family, had the stagecoach stop in on top of Monument Mountain, out of Monument. And you know the chapter in the Annie in the Milk Wagon? That was my grandma on my mother's side. My mother's mother, who had 12 children, was married to a man, 45, when she was 14. When she was 14, and he was quite brutal, and he was also a drunk and was too old to work in his later years. So, you know, this is the behind the scenes. It sounds very noble that she was, you know, going out with her milk wagon every morning, and it's kind of romantic and nostalgic. And like you say, it looks nice on the surface, but at the same time, she was trying to support 12 kids when her husband was laying drunk on the sofa, you know, and so, you know, and much, much older than her. And so, and she, in her own way, was a businesswoman, too, because she kept the kids together and bought them school shoes and kept them all in school to graduate from high school in Monument by selling milk on the streets and raising crops.
It is a very different picture of life in that era than we're really usually presented with. And it seems like it's not only a difficult life, it's not exactly lawless, but it's, there isn't a lot of I'm trying to figure out how to word this. People weren't very responsible, I guess, is kind of it. The women kind of picked things up and kept them going, but the men were, you know, for the most part, not even there.
I think they were responsible in different ways. It certainly wasn't an age where men carried their babies in, you know, baby holders on their breasts. In fact, the fathers were largely absent from the children's lives in the cases I knew, and certainly in my family. I got to know my dad as an adult more than as a child. Yeah, they were out doing their thing in the barn and with the animals, and I think it was much more divided, the chores. The women were taking care of the kids in the house. But it is interesting to me, and a lot of my scholarship has been on women's roles in history and literature, and how much we have had in history that's come down to us in our education and in our mythology. It's all been men. It's all been the work of men and what they were doing, but how much the women behind the scenes have held everything together.
Can you give me another example from the kind of scholarship that you've done where it was really the women who were holding things together?
Yeah, I did a book in years past on Wallala in Mendocino County, California, on the women, and this is all about logging and shipping and railroad and all men stuff. So everywhere I went, I'd interviewed women, and but interestingly enough, the people I interviewed were women in their 80s because the men mainly were not around. They were mainly had died already. And the women would tell me what I would say, what were you doing? Because I wanted the women's view of history underneath the men's. And they would say, well, my husband did this. My husband worked in the sawmill. Well, what did you do? Well, my son, now he was on the short line railroad up here. But what did you do? Well, my brother worked in the woods. But what did you do? Oh, I just stayed home and had babies. But it would come out that they had actually done everything. They had worked in the sawmill, too, and even in the woods and even on the shipping, but they had to accept a check in their husband's name because they couldn't be paid in their own name. So it never got technically down that they were doing it. You almost had to find out this history through personal interview.
They had the checks made out in their husband's names?
That they could only be paid in their husband's names, which of course meant their husbands had to cash a check for their labor.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that too. That was in 1980 that I did that.
Wow. And so what era was this that the women were paid in their husband's names?
Well, the women I was interviewing in like the late 70s, the book came out in 1980, would have been maybe in their 80s at that time. So if they're talking their childhoods, it was probably the 20s, the 30s, I would say.
And what was the name of that book?
The name is Wallala Lee. It's a hard name to spell and pronounce, but it's like, because it's an Indian word, which means water coming down place. This is a town where the river meets the ocean and in Northern California. And it was a history of Mendocino County, California, basically.
Right. Okay. And so my guest has been Annette White Parks. We've been talking about her book, Cowboy of the Rim Rocks. And if you want to contact Annette about this book or any of her other books, you can email her at white-pa.anne at uwlax.edu. Annette, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.